that he win a decisive victory and certainly clear 50%, so he can really sprint into his administration claiming a strong mandate for these ambitious programs he wants to advance.
Well, tell me, John, is Mondami's general election campaign more or less the same, or is it different from his underdog primary campaign that so electrified the city?
Well, it's the same in that his stated platform remains exactly the same of the fast and free buses, rent freeze for rent-regulated tenants, setting up a government-run grocery stores, and things like that. He hasn't changed that one bit. What he has done, he's definitely put a lot more energy into trying to woo the Democratic establishment and get them on board with supporting him and trying to build out a broader coalition of support. And I think he's had some success with that. Obviously, there's key Democrats that are holding out, but I think he's gradually chipping away. You know, a lot of Democrats, I think, have resigned themselves to the fact that this guy is very likely the next mayor and they want to play ball with him. And I think he's also, I mean, his personality definitely helps him. He's got a very congenial personality. He's very intelligent. A lot of these figures that feel heard by him, he hasn't really changed his line, but he's just a very warm and engaging and intelligent person. So I think there are people that are wary of him, but feel like that he's not going to be so dogmatic that it's going to be impossible to work with him. And they've made their decision to try to play ball.
John Tarleton, many of New York's most prominent Democrats are still refusing to endorse Mamdani. Why do you think that is? And what does that say about the Democratic Party establishment?
Well, one, I think it says they're deeply out of touch with their rank-and-file voters, especially the younger voters who came out overwhelmingly to support Zoran. And, of course, that was a key reason the Democrats lost the presidency in 2024. The youth vote drifted away from them. Zoran won overwhelmingly with all racial groups under 45 years old across the board. And, of course, he did especially well with South Asian and Muslim voters. The party establishment's really out of touch with a lot of key constituencies and just not acknowledging that. And then, of course, I think it says everything about the party establishment's relationship with the billionaire donor class that is really unhappy about Mamdani, and they are unwilling to buck these people. And a lot of the key donors, you know, are aligned with AIPAC, the big Israel lobby. I wouldn't say it's only the Israel lobby, but it's definitely a big part of it. You know, I think this is a tension that runs throughout Democratic politics, Democratic Party politics, is the divide between what the Democratic Party donor class wants and what its rank-and-file voters wants. And that divide has greatly expanded since Kamala Harris was defeated in last year. And the party establishment, I think, is increasingly reviled by its people who supported it in the past for being so deeply ineffectual. And a lot of people see Zoran as a breath of fresh air and somebody that could, you know, lead the city to a better place and really be a symbol of a different kind of politics that's possible if the party establishment would just get out of the way. And we're also seeing here in New York, a lot of these establishment figures are much more comfortable fighting, suppressing the left than actually fighting Trump. And again, that's, I think, becoming deeply alienating to a lot of the party rank and file that in the past was, you know, more, it felt more warmly about their party leaders.
Well, you know, you mentioned, John, that Mamdani would like to win, but win beyond just a small margin. He'd like to win as big as he possibly can. What are some of the voting blocks, therefore, that he's trying to add to his coalition, in addition to the, well, unprecedented turnout from younger voters and Muslim and South Asian voters in the primary?
Yeah, for one thing, there's a lot of independent voters that didn't vote in June because the Democratic primary was restricted to Democratic voters. And a lot of those are people who kind of fit the profile of people who were supporting Mamdani. They just weren't registered as Democrats. So Mamdani's campaign is definitely trying to identify those people and get, who would tend to be younger and get them out to the polls. But beyond that, there's definitely a lot of outreach to the Jewish community. Again, a lot of kind of older liberal Jewish voters are skittish about Mamdani. There's been a lot of propaganda from the Zionists about how Mamdani is going to, put Jews in danger and all of that kind of stuff. Mamdani has worked assiduously to calm those fears without abandoning his position on Palestine and demanding an end to the genocide in Gaza. New York City Comptroller Brad Lander, who did a big endorsement for Zoran in the primary, is a big help to that. Lander is Jewish himself. He's a rabbi in a synagogue and very well respected among liberal Jews. So, we'll see if those folks can be mollified without conceding to their Zionist positions. And then also older black voters who have voted for Andrew Cuomo and his father, Mario Cuomo, a former governor for decades. They stayed loyal to Cuomo in the primary, but now that Zoran is the Democratic nominee, he's working very hard to convince them to come around to supporting him. So I think he's working really hard at trying to expand that coalition without abandoning his core program.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with John Tarleton, the editor-in-chief and founder of the Independent newspaper here in New York City. John, the Democratic Socialists of America are the largest socialist organization in the U.S. in more than a century. The New York City chapter of the DSA has been Zoran's political home since 2017. What role are they playing in his general election campaign? And what kind of role do you think the organization will have in his administration, assuming he takes office on January 1st?
Right. So New York City DSA has emerged as an electoral powerhouse here in the city over the last 8 or 9 years. And in the fall, it will be leading the ground campaign for Zoran as it did in the primary. They're doing a big push this weekend on the first weekend of fall to really get people out. And that will, I think, continue through the election. It wasn't just DSA people who are the volunteers and the canvassers, but they provide the infrastructure and the organization that allows those tens of thousands of people to plug into what's happening. And that's absolutely continuing all the way through Election Day. I'm pretty confident in saying that as soon as the election is over, and assuming Zoran wins, they will pivot to continuing to canvass and mobilize people, but this time in support of Zoran's agenda. Because a lot of what Zoran Mamdani wants to do will require support from the state government in Albany, especially funding for initiatives like the fast and free buses, the universal child care, and things like that. Our state government, especially our governor, who finally endorsed Mamdani this week, have been more friendly toward wealthy interests that don't want their taxes increased. And that'll be the central battle next spring when the annual state budget is debated, is can Zoran Mamdani, DSA, and other allied organizations create enough political pressure that the state government in Albany, essentially throws its support and its resources behind what he wants to do. The governor is up for re-election next year, so if there's a wave of momentum behind Mayor Mamdani and his agenda, I don't think she will be able to fully ignore that. So we're going to see a real power struggle between the movement that Zoran and the DSA have built and, the sort of more established way of doing things in Albany where wealthy interests are catered to. One of the interesting things about New York City DSA, it is definitely, I would say, the sort of the leadership of the organization. I mean, they obviously envision a large role for DSA, but they also want to bring together a coalition of groups, outside of DSA, other progressive organizations. They see DSA as sort of the left pole of a broader coalition to actually win promises that Mamdani has been making. And I think you will see, just as Mamdani's electoral campaign has created an unprecedented level of mobilization in the, 1.6 million doors that were knocked on the primary, and that's continuing this fall. I think that level of mobilization will continue into next year and going forward. And we're going to, I think, have a different kind of politics that involves a lot more public engagement and public mobilization around things that are very broadly popular with voters. And now, next year will be about winning the program. This year is about winning the election.
Well, John, please, if you would, talk about how Mamdani's critics, though, have been trying to pit Mamdani against the Democratic Socialists of America. They've been doing this by highlighting some of the more controversial positions held by the DSA. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, a few years ago, the National DSA, at kind of the height of the defund the police era around 2020, 2021, it definitely took some positions on policing, on full decriminalization of all drugs, full decriminalization of all sex work, and non-prosecution of misdemeanors, and various things that I think make sense to the left and to people that really want to see the police and carceral state rolled back. But these positions have not achieved a broad popularity with the larger public. I mean, some of that's because of right-wing media propaganda or whatever. But at the end of the day, these are kind of Nietzsche positions at this point. And Mamdani has made his campaign about affordability, about making life easier for the working class with the kind of programs he's proposing. And the one sort of policing initiative he is putting out there is he wants to create something called a Department of Community Safety, where that would provide services like assisting mentally ill people, people with drug addictions, other things like that, people in crisis who don't need a police officer in their face. They need real help. So, but he's putting that forward as a supplement to the NYPD. He's stopped talking about, defunding the NYPD budget because it would be broadly unpopular. And I think something the left has had to grapple with is, while working class and even people of color communities don't like being abused by the police, they don't want racist policing, they are not comfortable with the idea of rolling policing back. They don't want to be victims of crime. So Mamdani's really had to navigate that. And so what some of his critics have tried to do is sort of hang the most far left positions of DSA on some of these policing issues onto Mamdani. And he's like, that's not in my platform. Judge me by what I'm proposing. So New York City DSA, I think, is willing to make those compromises because, they see a path to victory here and the path to being able to accomplish a lot.
John, if he becomes mayor, Mamdani will oversee the largest police force in the country. What are your thoughts on the challenges he'll face in dealing with the NYPD and how he might deal with them?
Yeah, this, along with dealing with Trump, dealing with the NYPD is going to be his greatest challenge. Politically, the NYPD, is very conservative, very kind of Trumpified itself. So he's going to have to walk a delicate line with the NYPD. I don't think he wants to go to war with it, because he wants to focus on getting this sort of redistributive agenda passed that he's promised and won so much support around. One key decision he'll have to make is whether to keep the current police commissioner, Jessica Tisch, who was appointed about a year ago. Our mayor, his previous police commissioners had been enmeshed in various scandals. Tisch kind of came and cleaned out the kind of good old boy network that Mayor Adams had put in the police department. So she's gotten rave reviews as a reformer, but she's, at the end of the day, a very conventional policing type figure. And she's also a billionaire heiress. She comes from one of the wealthiest families in New York City. And many people think that she will try to run for mayor in 4 years as sort of the candidate of restoration of traditional ruling class politics in the city. So I think it would be crazy for Mamdani to keep her in office where she could cause him a lot of trouble. And I think my impression is that he's probably going to bring someone else in and thank her for her service and then show her the door. But there will be a lot of challenges because, I mean, if the NYPD, okay, if there's an officer who gets shot on the job, you know, the press will blame Mamdani for being, you know, too permissive on crime. You know, what happens if there's clashes between protesters and police over, you know, whatever issue people might be protesting? You know, the police department and the establishment will demand that he, you know, show his love for, you know, the police department, but his movement would be look askance at that. So that's definitely a delicate line he's going to have to walk. And God forbid if there was like a major terrorist incident, especially if it was carried out by a, you know, group from the Middle East, then, I mean, that would, I can only imagine the blowback, you know, what that would come with that, even though it would be completely unfair and unjustified. So, yeah, the police department, all I can say is I hope he can find a police commissioner that's at least trustworthy and do his best to keep the NYPD from going off the rails and causing him a lot of trouble.
Well, John, talk to us, though, about Trump's threats, his threat, you know, to flood New York City with ICE agents, National Guard troops, when Mamdani becomes, and if he does become mayor, if not sooner. How do you see all that playing out?
So, Jim, to answer your question, it is possible Trump could cause trouble around Election Day with sending ICE or National Guard troops into New York. More likely, he'll try to cause trouble once Mamdani is mayor, do everything he can to try to undermine Mamdani, whether that's sending ICE agents in, doing massive raids in immigrant communities and destabilizing those communities, sending in, you know, National Guard troops from other states. It would be hugely unpopular here in New York. I would say that it also, if that happens, there is a chance for Mamdani to build a broad sort of unity around his leadership, because really no major political forces in New York, including the business community and the police force itself, want this. If Trump were to send, you know, the National Guard in saying, oh, you know, New York is overrun by crime, that's implicitly a criticism of the NYPD that they're not doing their job. And Commissioner Tisch just last week said she thought the idea of the National Guard coming into New York was revolting. So Mamdani could use it to build support around his leadership, because those moves by Trump would be widely rejected here in New York.
Well, John, sadly, we are out of time, but before we let you go, if our listeners want to get the Independent themselves, they want to be able to read it, they want to read it as you're following the Mamdani campaign, they may see that as one of the best sources for doing so. How do they go about doing that?
Well, you can subscribe to our monthly print edition by going to our website, independent.org, independent.org, and there's a subscribe button on the website. You get every copy delivered straight to your mailbox. And then also, we have our weekly radio show on WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York, and streaming on WBAI.org. And we'll, you know, be following the everything around Mamdani and his administration very closely on the airwaves as well.
John Tarleton, it's been a real pleasure for Jim and I to have you on Law & Disorder. We wish your newspaper every success. We wish the Mamdani campaign every success. And we'll get back to you later on, see how things are rolling out. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Humankind has, happily, made considerable progress in extending legal rights to the non-human animal world, but certainly from the point of view of animal rights advocates, we've still got a long way to go. So today on Law & Disorder, we'll speak with an attorney whose practice includes animal rights law, to discuss some of the recent pluses and minuses in the battle to secure legal protection for the animals with whom we share this planet. Our guest is attorney Matthew Strugar. Mr. Strugar was previously director of litigation for the PETA Foundation, which is the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Matthew Strugar is now in private practice, where, in addition to animal law, his practice includes handling civil rights cases, cases of police misconduct, the First Amendment, prisoners' rights, and the defense of political protesters. Well, Matthew Strugar, a very warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk with you guys.
Let me ask you this, Matthew, to start off with. Since animal law and animal rights can mean a lot of different things to different people, I wonder if you could start us off by, well, explaining the broad categories of laws that are meant to protect animals.
Sure. So there aren't too many laws designed to protect animals directly, but there are some, and they kind of operate at different levels. So at the federal level, which applies nationwide, there's laws that I think people are generally familiar with, like the Endangered Species Act, which is primarily thought of as protecting wild animals who are under threat of extinction of some kind. But in recent years, people have creatively applied that to captive animals who are held at zoos or other places. But there's also the Animal Welfare Act, which generally sets minimum standards for some animals in laboratories and some animals who are exhibited by zoos or circuses or other animal exhibitors. And I say some animals because the Animal Welfare Act exempts all rats and mice, and those animals make up more than 95% of animals used in experiments, which is more than 110 million of them in U.S. labs at any given time. So rats and mice have no protection under federal law. You could literally take a blowtorch to a mouse for fun in a U.S. laboratory, and it wouldn't violate any federal law, or especially wouldn't violate the Animal Welfare Act. Those are the major federal protections. Also note that the Animal Welfare Act does not apply to animals raised in food production, so not on family, on factory farms or anything like that, which I think is often a misconception. Then on the state level, you generally have animal cruelty laws designed to protect animals. Every state has some version of that. Certain states have more protections than others, but they generally operate, you know, just on a vague standard of, you know, you can't inflict unnecessary or wanton cruelty to an animal. And then certain states have even more protective laws. California, for instance, sets certain standards for space for confining birds and pigs. It bans the sale of products that are generally sold elsewhere, like fur or kangaroo leather or foie gras. So different states operate differently. And then on the local level, you can get all kinds of sort of cutting-edge protections in more progressive places. So cities like West Hollywood, for instance, was the first in the country to ban cat declawing, to ban fur sales, to ban the sale, retail sale of dogs and cats versus, you know, just adopting from a rescue, that kind of thing. Those all went on, after starting in West Hollywood, to become state-level protections in California. And then just 3 days ago, West Hollywood banned the live animal sales throughout the city, and that includes rodents, lizards, fish, hermit crabs, and every other species, and that's the first in the country to do that. So that's an overview of animal protection law generally. Animal law itself involves trying to use those laws to protect animals, but also trying to use other aspects of the law, be it criminal defense or consumer protection or constitutional litigation or anything else, to try to advance the rights of animals using legal doctrines that were set up mostly involving human beings.
Matthew, before we get into a couple of recent cases, can you also give us a little historical background on how heavy-handed the government has been in investigating and even prosecuting animal rights activists? And how do various laws on civil rights and civil liberties factor in?
Sure. So in the mid-2000s through about the mid-2010s, there was some significant federal investigations, prosecutions, and surveillance of both animal rights and environmental activists. It was a time period some people in the movement dubbed the Green Scare. There was a top FBI official who testified to Congress that environmental and animal rights extremists were the number one domestic terror threat that the nation faced, despite neither of those groups having taken a human life and despite it being only a few years past, you know, like the September 11th attacks. you know, as part of the Green Scare, the federal government prosecuted scores of animal rights and environmental activists, often seeking sentences that lasted decades. Some of those prosecutions were for things like property destruction, like burning down a research facility for genetically modified timber, and those kinds of cases that you would normally see, you know, if they were just not politically motivated, they would normally not be sort of elevated to a federal prosecution level, but tried at the state level. But as part of the Green Scare, these all became federal cases, and federal crimes often involve much lengthier prison sentences, much harsher prison sentences. But other prosecutions were just against movement leaders who weren't really alleged to have participated in illegal actions, but really spoke out in favor of them and sort of cheered on those who were doing them. So obviously there were significant First Amendment implications there. The National Lawyers Guild was one of the groups that was willing to stick its neck out and offer amicus support, and often the guild lawyers were on the forefront of the criminal defense in those kinds of cases. It's hard to really like have a quick summary of how that all played out. I'd say there were some wins, there were some more losses than there were wins. But I think the wins often stymied any further government overreach. And we just haven't seen those kinds of prosecutions in the last 10 years the way we had in sort of the 10 years that preceded it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matthew, let's talk about some cases now. I'm thinking, for example, of the case called The People of the State of California versus Shung, which began, as I understand it, as a criminal case. Brought against the leader of an animal rights organization. But tell us about the underlying case. Why was Mr. Shung being prosecuted in the first place, and what was he charged with?
Certainly. So Wayne Shung is something of a charismatic leader in a certain segment of the animal rights movement. He is the co-founder of an organization called Direct Action Everywhere, which, as its name might suggest, is committed to engaging in acts of civil disobedience to save animals. And they're often prosecuted for it. So in this instance, there was a large group of members of this group, some of whom were outside of a poultry factory, and others of whom marched onto the poultry factory farm, identified animals who appeared sick or injured, and walked out with them and took them to receive veterinary care. They also took the animals to the police to show that they're terrible conditions and ask that the police sort of investigate and prosecute the farm for animal cruelty. So they weren't exactly trying to hide what they were doing. They were, it's very open sort of action. Other members of the group locked themselves to the farm's front gate. And for either of those two actions, either walking onto the farm or locking down to the gate, I think anyone might reasonably expect to be arrested or prosecuted for those actions. But Mr. Shung didn't do either of those two things. Instead, he was with the group that was outside the farm, and he stood on the side of the road and addressed other demonstrators who were there but not breaking the law. And he said, through a megaphone, something along the lines of, "We have to be here to support the people who are putting their neck on the line. If people need water, give them water. If they need food, give them food. Let them know you appreciate the sacrifice they're making." Things like that. And for that, the Sonoma County District Attorney's Office charged him and convicted him for aiding and abetting the trespass that the other activists were already involved with when he gave his speech supporting them.
Man, I understand there's an appeal pending that focuses on legal issues, including the First Amendment and the necessity defense. There's also an amicus brief filed by some heavy hitters in support of Mr. Shung. So let's start with the First Amendment. How's it play into Mr. Shung's case, and what are the key arguments on both sides?
Sure. So on the First Amendment, the arguments basically on Mr. Shung's side is that giving a speech supporting a protest, even if you're supporting an unlawful protest, is still protected activity. And that sort of comes out of the famous Brandenburg versus Ohio case, 1968 from the U.S. Supreme Court, maybe one of the most important First Amendment cases from the last century, where the Supreme Court said that advocating for illegal action can only be prosecuted if it is, one, intended to cause the illegal action, two, likely to cause that illegal action, and three, the illegal action is imminent, meaning it's set to happen that second, and it isn't advocacy for some illegal action in the future. So that's basically where our sort of First Amendment rights to encourage any kind of illegal action comes from. or at least is protected by, is this Brandenburg standard. So in Mr. Shunk's case, the judge gave a jury instruction saying that it could be aiding and abetting a crime to, quote, promote the crime. Well, you know, what is promotion if not advocacy, or the inverse, what's advocacy if not promotion? They're almost synonymous. So that issue is now up on appeal, and Mr. Shung has solid amicus support from organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU of Northern California, and even the National Lawyers Guild on this issue, where those organizations, along with Mr. Shung, are saying, including the definition of promote in the aiding and abetting theory of liability sort of violates the First Amendment's protections under Brandenburg versus Ohio.
All right. Well, then let's turn next then to Mr. Shung's necessity defense. Can you explain what that is in this context, the basic arguments again on both sides, and where do you think it might go? How do you think the court might rule?
Sure. Well, the necessity defense in classic terms is a defense that says, yes, I might have committed this crime or this tort, but I had no other choice. The classic example they use in law school involves driving down the road, another car is speeding at you, or a large truck is speeding at you head on. You swerve to avoid that head on collision, but you drive onto someone's property and maybe, you know, you hit their fence or something like that. Okay, so maybe that's technically a trespass, or even the damage to the fence is what the law calls trespass to chattels. But you had no other choice, so necessity would be a defense if you were charged with trespass, either in a tort or a crime. And then that's the classic definition that you learn in law school. In the 70s and the 1980s, this became a popular tool with social justice movements. So, for instance, peace activists would march onto military bases and pour red paint on missiles or seek to disarm them if they knew how to do such a thing. And when they were prosecuted, they would argue it was necessary to do what they did because they were trying to prevent deaths from war. That was sometimes successful. That was sometimes not, you know, more often not than it was, but it, you know, it's a tool. And so animal rights activists have tried to use the necessity defense as well, usually again without success, but sometimes with success. And so Mr. Shung tried to use necessity here, arguing that even if he was aiding and abetting the trespass with his speech, those activists who were trespassing were engaged in the trespass out of necessity to save the lives of these birds who were sick and injured and in desperate need of veterinary care. The trial court said no, the necessity defense is limited only to saving human life. The trial court seems to have sort of invented that rule from whole cloth. I think most people would think that if they see a dog roasting in a car on a hot summer day, they can break the window to save the dog's life. And there are plenty of states that have enacted, you know, sort of statutory necessary defenses there to say that, you know, to sort of give that kind of legal protection to somebody who takes that action. But the judge would say that that could be a crime for which there's no necessity defense. So that's another issue for Mr. Shung's appeal that's attracting some attention. On this issue, he has additional amicus support from a group of legal scholars, most of not all of whom are involved in some form of animal law, but they include some legal heavy hitters like Michael Dorf at Cornell, Martha Nussbaum at the University of Chicago, Larry Tribe at Harvard, some names that should really pop out to the Court of Appeal, saying, you know, there's no such limitation and the court should not recognize a limitation for necessity only being related to involving human life. So it'll be interesting to see how that issue plays out. There was actually just an interesting op-ed in the LA Times just yesterday by Catherine Stilt and Matthew Liebman, animal law professors at Harvard and University of San Francisco, sort of detailing this issue and sort of what's at stake in this appeal. And it was nice to see the LA Times covering it.
Another really intriguing case I wanted to get your thoughts on involves the question of what happens when there are laws on the books to protect animals, but no government agency is actually enforcing the laws. There was a recent case on this issue called Karoo Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals. And I understand the society just had a win in the appeals court. Tell us about this case, please. What prompted the lawsuit? What were the key legal issues? And what did the courts decide?
Sure. So I'm really excited about this case, but unfortunately it takes a good bit of setup. So bear with me. So for the setup, California has some really progressive animal protection laws, but oftentimes there's absolutely no one in government who has any interest in enforcing them. So like I said earlier, California bans the sale of leather made from kangaroos. It prohibits the sale of fur products. It prohibits the sale of foie gras, among other things. But oftentimes you really can't get anyone to do anything about it. There are fur retailers that are continuing to operate in LA County, you know, as if there's no law addressing those sales. No matter how many complaints people make to enforcement authorities, you know, California Fish and Wildlife is tasked with enforcing it. And, you know, Fish and Wildlife thinks they should be protecting fish and wildlife, which makes sense, and not going out and, you know, enforcing sort of, you know, consumer laws. So if the authorities won't enforce the law, and there's no provision in the law that allows private parties like concerned citizens or animal rights groups to bring lawsuits to enforce the laws, how do they get enforced? And that's where this case and generally these Societies for the Protection of Animals, or SPCAs, come in. Now, I think most people think of SPCAs as, you know, these organizations that run animal shelters and adopt dogs out, and some do that. Most of them do that. But the California Corporations Code allows anyone to form an SPCA. It's just sort of a different kind of corporation you can form in California. And the Corporations Code that deals with SPCAs has a provision that says SPCAs may, quote, proffer a complaint against any person before any court or magistrate having jurisdiction for the violation of any law relating to or affecting animals. So some enterprising attorneys at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, which is sort of the leading animal law public interest firm, took a look at that and decided to try it out. And this case was litigated by one of their younger lawyers, who's an up-and-coming star, Christina Cladis. And that's sort of the legal setup. The factual setup for the case that ALDF, the Animal Legal Defense Fund, brought was that there's a woman in Solano County who's running this dog breeding business out of her backyard, and she's just hoarding these dogs, and they're in terrible veterinary conditions. And sometimes these dogs got loose in the area where she lived and would terrorize the towns. And the SPCA decided they wanted to do something about it. So together with ALDF, they filed a complaint under the Corporations Code saying she was violating these laws applicable to dog breeders, even if the criminal authorities wouldn't do anything about her violations of those laws. And the dog breeder came into court and said, no, only prosecutors can file these kinds of cases. We can't just be deputizing SPCAs to file lawsuits that the law doesn't otherwise allow them to file. These are criminal laws, and they should be, you know, enforced by criminal authorities. But then their argument was basically that the authorization in the Corporations Code to file a, quote, complaint meant that they could complain to the DA, but the DA had to be the one to do something about it, the district attorney. So earlier this summer, the First District Court of Appeal for California rejected that argument and said there's no basis in California's Corporations Code to find that the authorization to file a complaint is limited to criminal complaints. And if it's not so limited, the SPCAs can come in and file a complaint seeking to enforce, quote, any law relating to or affecting animals. And originally the decision was unpublished, meaning it wouldn't have precedential effect. But just last month, they decided to publish the decision, meaning it's precedent for the whole state. And so while this case alone might involve something of a small-time dog breeder, I think the legal implications are pretty huge. And the legal implications are playing out in another case right now, where a different SPCA, represented by a different advocacy organization, is suing a chicken factory farm for violations of the animal cruelty law for conditions that the chickens have to live in. And the defendant in that case is running around screaming like their hair is on fire over this idea that SPCAs can just come in and address the cruelty to animals on factory farms. And while the trial court allowed the case to continue, the factory farm took an emergency writ to the California Court of Appeals, where all these big animal agriculture groups like the Cattlemen's Association and the Farm Bureau and the Poultry Federation came in and said the sky is going to fall if courts allow these kinds of cases to continue. But sort of by luck of timing, the other case, the case involving the dog breeder, the Caru case, sort of set the precedent that already applied statewide. So by the time the Court of Appeals issued the decision in that case, it bound this other court that was deciding this case. So just last week, the California Court of Appeals said they were not going to intervene and allowed that case to go forward in the trial court. And I think all that might light a path for enforcement of all these good laws that are just sitting there in cases, or at least in California, that are just being flouted. So if SPCAs are willing to step up, people won't need to rely on prosecutors or health departments or whoever else to enforce these laws that they don't really want to enforce. The SPCAs can just go directly to court and get an injunction saying these corporations have to knock it off. And that could be a really powerful enforcement mechanism because, you know, all the laws you pass to protect animals don't mean anything if there's no one who's willing to enforce them.
Well, Matthew, let's step back a little bit and look at what is really a broader question for all of the issues of animal rights law that we've been talking about today. Because over the past several decades, we've seen a great many more animal rights cases. We've seen more attorneys like yourself who prosecute such cases. And I assume that you think there's been some progress, although I suspect not enough, in protecting the rights of animals over these past several decades. So part of the question I wanted to ask you, is that in fact the case? And if it is, in what areas of animal rights law would you say there has been some progress, some advancements, if you will, in the rights of animals? And conversely, in what areas of animal rights law would you say there has been too little advancement?
In my opinion, the biggest advancements have been companion animal issues. And when animal law talks about companion animal issues, they mostly mean pets, so dogs and cats and things like that. So, you know, there's a problem that sort of vexed animal rights or just sort of companion animal issues for a long time, which was that in tort law or in any law, animals are considered property. And oftentimes, if somebody came and just like did some horrible crime to your dog or your cat, and you wanted to sue them for that, the damages would be the replacement value for the dog or the cat. That was basically all you could get. There was no sort of sentimental value or any kind of like attachment value that was placed in the pet. So if, you know, it cost $25 to adopt a cat at the local shelter, that's basically all you got, no matter what anyone did. There was a, you know, something of an interesting case, I think, out of New York in the 90s, where they talked about, well, you know, some kind of, you know, family heirlooms can get sentimental value, but even dogs and cats could not. And, you know, the court pointed out, if the animal was, you know, dead and stuffed and on your mantle and someone came in and hit it with a bat, you could get, you know, the value for your emotional attachment to the stuffed animal on your mantle. But if somebody did that to your living, you know, companion animal, you could not get those kinds of damages. And that's starting to change, which makes a lot of sense, I think, to a lot of people, to anyone who certainly had an animal as their family member. There's been, you know, some slow progress on laws affecting animals in laboratories, animals on farms, but much less. One area that there has been a lot of progress involving laboratories are these bills that say that these animal labs, after they are done experimenting on the animals, often for many years, have to at least try to adopt them out or give the or turn the animals for non-human primates or something like that, turn them over to sanctuaries. So there's more and more laws like that popping up in states saying that they have to at least try. I'll tell you, like, the animal laboratories fight these bills really, really hard, which is surprising, because all it says is, you know, give them to an animal shelter, don't just kill them. But some of these animals who, there's a lot of beagles used in labs because beagles are so loyal. They are easy to manipulate in the labs. Basically, they don't fight back very much. And these labs debark the animals so that they'll be quieter. So they take out their vocal cords or they snap their vocal cords. And then what happens is when people adopt out those animals, they use those animals to show people what, you know, actually happens in labs. Like, look what happened to this dog. You know, it's the most loyal dog in the world. And that's why they used him, and, you know, they cut his vocal cords. And it can sort of lead to change in sentiment around using dogs in laboratories and that kind of thing. So there's been some progress there, but, you know, the progress is slow. There's more animals in labs today than there has ever been, and there's more animals on factory farms in the United States than there ever has been. So, you know, in sort of the broad scheme of things, there's still a lot of work to do, but we take the victories where we can get them.
We're talking with Matthew Strugar, who is an animal rights lawyer, among other matters that he handles in his law firm here in Los Angeles. We're talking to him today about his work as an animal rights lawyer. Matthew, I wonder, where can listeners learn more about animal law and animal rights? And of course, where can they learn more about you and your work?
Sure. On the topic of animal law, there are, you know, a couple of good organizations out there that I would normally point people to who are interested in learning about more. The first is the Animal Legal Defense Fund, which is sort of the first and premier animal litigation nonprofit outfit in the United States. And their website has a lot of resources. Another area is the Brooks Institute for Animal Law and Policy, which is a center run out of Harvard Law School. That is a good resource for both animal law practitioners and those aspiring to learn more about the practice and the field and the jurisprudence of animal law. To learn more about me, I have a website. There's not a whole lot out there, but it's just MatthewStrugar.com, myname.com. And there's some little blurbs about the kinds of cases I do that involve, you know, a lot more than animals, a lot of, you know, animal rights, prisoners' rights, protesters' rights kind of stuff as well.
Matthew Strugar, it's been a pleasure having you with us today, and we just thank you so much for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Matthew.
Yeah, anytime.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
You're listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh. To WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM, WRCT.org. On the web, my name is Steve, host of the Deep Blues Hour, bringing you 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues. And in this hour, we're going to hear from the likes of Mr. Wynonie Harris. Yeah, good morning to him. Mr. Johnny Shines as well will be giving us some traditional blues while he's arguing about it. Plus, we'll hear from John Jackson. About his money. It's all coming up here on this hour of the Deep Blues Hour. But why don't we start off with Mr. Magic Slim and his Teardrops from a release called Blue Magic. This is You Got to Pay. Magic Slim here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Matter what I do, nothing ever goes right, but you gotta pay. you come back, cause you ain't paid.
WRCT is supported by Attic Records, located in Millvale. Attic Records is open 7 days a week, selling new and used records and CDs from a range of genres. Attic Records is an independently owned and operated shop that purchases used records and CDs from collectors. Attic is located at 513 Grant Avenue in Millvale. For more information about selling records or records that are available, including new releases, call 412-821-8484 or visit atticrecordstoreinc.com. If you are interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities.
Got my mind on my woman. I can't even sleep at night. Yes, I got my mind on my woman. And I can't even sleep at night. Sit down to my table. I can't even eat a bite. Oh, she say I ran her away from home. I threatened her with death. I tried to get her to come back home. She said, Mighty Joe, don't hold your breath. I got my mind on my woman. I can't even sleep. Returning. I thought our spark was over, and I can't get over that. I got my mind on my woman, and I can't even think too far. Sit down to my table, I can't even eat a bite. Oh, she got my head all messed up, man. I don't know which way to go. Can you?
kiss in your face.
Speak about the rights of nature. The rights of the river were recognized in Aotearoa, the Klamath River. The rights of mountains have been recognized in the Ecuadorian constitutional law. And a few years ago,